Hello, this is your host, Paul Harvey. We're going to go back this week to February 2022 when I shared a podcast with Scott Stokely. And at the time, I was so inspired by this man because when I had the conversation, he said to me, "I am the wealthiest homeless person you will ever meet." So if you ever played Frisbee, well, this man plays it for a living. So in a moment, I'll let my younger self tell you so much more about Scott. But in the meantime, I just want to remind you about focus coaching. I've been having some amazing results, really, with people who are getting stuff done in this difficult environment. So if you have any challenges in your life about getting stuff done, do check out the links towards focus coaching, because that will really make a difference to your productivity and success. Anyway, back to my younger self, and we'll tell you all about Scott Stokely. My name is Paul Harvey, and you are listening to Life, Passion and Business, a podcast born out of my desire to find greater meaning in life at the time when I thought there was none. Since that day, I have spoken to hundreds of people, and what I have discovered is that our story is everything. Because what we do, feel or experience is based on the stories that we tell ourselves. It's time to explore what it means to live a good life. How do we make this experience better? And more importantly, how do we lead the world to a better place?
I was working nights, putting myself through college, and I had a disc golf tournament coming up in a couple months that I needed to take a Friday off in order to go to. And I'm arguing with him to get this day off for something that was important to me, 2 months away, that I had earned. And after battling with him, I ended up getting the day off. But I remember walking away thinking, if I stay in college, I'm going to be doing the exact same thing I just did today in 20 years. I'll just be being paid more money for it. But ultimately, I'm working for someone else. That's what I'm going to be doing. Someone else is going to have control over my life. And that it just hit me that that didn't make sense to me. I dropped out of college. I dropped out of school and just hit the road.
I have been so looking forward to sharing this conversation with you, as my guest on the show today is a professional Frisbee player, and that just makes me chuckle. In this discussion, we talk about the gap between thought and implementation, fear, failure, and the evidence that life always works out. There are certain rules that people like to live by, and one of them is that we have a place to live, somewhere to call home, to sleep and keep our things. Who said that was a rule? Could you live a nomadic life on the road, traveling from city to city and living in hotels? That is the life my guest, Scott Stokely, has chosen. And as you heard in the intro, he made that decision when he was 19. Now in his 50s, he joked with me that he's probably the most well-off homeless person I will ever meet. Scott Stokely is a professional disc golf player, and when he started in that sport 30 years ago, the game was in its infancy. He left home and set out to become a professional player with no plan B. And that is what's so amazing about this conversation. He's always just jumped. He always had an innate confidence in himself and a knowledge that it would be fine. And that is how the world works. For Scott, failure is just information and means adaptation is needed. Scott is an entrepreneur, and a very good one. He explains to us how he turned his hobby into a profession and a living. How he invented the funding model that most professional disc golf players use today. And how he wrote the first book on disc golf techniques. This discussion is about freedom, opportunity, and Scott shares his business and life model that could be replicated by anyone. Our call is recorded on the road, and Scott was speaking to us from his beloved Jeep Luna, which means the sound quality is not as good as it would usually be, but that does not take away from the quality of this conversation. And by the way, if you've not tried the game, it's a great fun and very well worth a go, and I'll say more about that at the end of the program. So let's join this conversation with Scott Stokely. He's also an author, and I'm sure lots of other things by the sounds of it. So Scott, thank you for taking the time to be here. I know you're a man on the road, so we're talking from a car, I believe.
Yeah, I am. I am permanently on the road. We don't even have a home base. Everything we couldn't take with us, we gave away or threw away. We are completely nomadic.
Wow. How does life work that way? I mean, don't you need addresses for like things these days? Or I guess you don't.
We have an address where we get our bills that we don't pay, but That's about it.
No, well, there we go. What can we say? So where did it all start for you, Scott? I mean, you obviously haven't always lived in a van or whatever it is you live in.
No. So this is actually my 10 and a half or 11th year traveling. And so I've toured for years. I'm happiest on the road. I toured for 8 years, stopped touring to raise my daughter. Basically, as soon as she was off to college, I'm back on the road for the rest of my life. I don't want to be in one place. So I always joke, I'm probably the most well-off homeless person you're ever going to meet. I'm not even close to struggling, but I like being on the road. I don't like being tied to a place.
Sounds like you have some Romani blood in you, because the Romanis don't know their home bases, do they? They like to travel and constantly travel. Well, the European Romanis do. I'm not sure you have Romanis in your country, but...
Yeah, no, we do. I was watching a documentary about what state has the most. I can't remember what it was, but I saw that. Yeah, they're everywhere.
So, okay, look, where did life start for you? You must have had a home base when you were young. Where did it all start for you?
So I grew up in Los Angeles. I played my first round of disc golf on the world's first course when it was the only course in the entire world. Now there's about 15,000 courses, 12 or 13 million players. It's global. It's blown up. But when I started, there was a handful of us basically that played. And I basically grew up playing Frisbee. It's not inaccurate to say that I'm a Frisbee player. That's how I grew up. I dropped out of school to play Frisbee full time. And then as soon as I was able to, and as soon as I recognized that I didn't want to fit into a mainstream world, I took off and hit the road to just travel.
So did you not do college or have a backup plan? Or was it always going to be the Frisbee life for you?
So basically the short of the story was I dropped out of school to play Frisbee full time when I was 15 years old. And then when I got to be 19-ish years old, I made the mistake of listening to other people about how you're supposed to live your life. So I enrolled in college. I spent a year and a half in college. And basically what happened was I was working nights, putting myself through college. Mm-hmm. And I had a disc golf tournament coming up in a couple months that I needed to take a Friday off in order to go to. Mm-hmm. And I was arguing with my boss, who at the time I thought he was an adult. He was probably 25 and I was 20, but he seemed like a grown up at the time. And I'm arguing with him to get this day off for something that was important to me 2 months away that I had earned with my, you know, with the way the days off work at this company. And after battling with him, I ended up getting the day off. But I remember walking away thinking, if I stay in college, I'm going to be doing the exact same thing I just did today in 20 years. I'll just be being paid more money for it. And it might not look like I'm debating my manager at Kinko's for a day off, but ultimately I'm working for someone else. That's what I'm going to be doing. Mm. Someone else is going to have control over my life. And that, it just hit me that didn't make sense to me. I dropped out of college. I dropped out of school and just hit the road. Wow. Not that day, but I mean, within a couple months.
You planned it. You planned it a bit. Yeah.
Well, a little bit. Yeah.
Whoa.
As far as having a back plan, that's one of the things I think is a bit of a myth, at least one of the barriers to people doing big things is I don't know what backup plan means. My backup plan is that I'll be fine wherever I am. If I fail at something, I'll just do something else and be fine. I don't need to know what the plan is. If I fail, I know that I will adapt to whatever happens. A backup plan or a safety net that's not necessary.
That is a quite a strong streak of resilience and confidence in yourself. Where did that come from?
You know, it's not so much a confidence in myself. It's a confidence that's the way the world works. I'll give you an example of this by way of example. I'll spare you the long story, but I was meeting someone. It was a woman I met, and she brought her son up, and we were meeting in a town, and we were going to go get an apartment together. And when they showed up, her son asked me, like, are you sure you're going to be able to find a place to live? because we were actually meeting. We booked some nights at a hotel while we were going to find a place. And I said, yeah, of course we'll find a place to live. That's not a problem. And he says, well, how do you know that you'll be able to find a place? How do you know you're going to be able to, succeed at this? And my answer was, go down to the local park. There's no people sleeping in the park. Everyone can do this. So it's just the knowledge that people can succeed at everything. I'm not any worse or less hardworking than anybody else. And if everyone else is able to survive, I don't have anxiety that I won't be able to.
Mm.
So really, it's not confidence in myself. It's just a confidence in the way the system and society works. As long as, if you're willing to work, you're fine. As long as you're willing to put one foot in front of the other.
Okay, so you're in your 20s. You set off on the road as a professional frisbee player. Sorry, I kind of have to keep saying that because I just think it's so funny. As a professional disc golf player, you set off on the road. So yeah, I mean it's a new sport. Did you have sponsorship or were you entirely relying on winning?
No. So there was some prize money, but it was very little. It's still very little today. Prize money in sports is extra in most sports. There's so many ways to monetize your hobby that don't involve winning tournaments. On a good year back in the 90s, I might have made $10,000 or $12,000 in prize money. And if you factor in my travel expenses, they were probably about $10,000 or $12,000. I mean, there was no money. But I merchandise, I endorsed products, I had sponsorship, I taught lessons. Monetizing a hobby is easy if you treat your hobby like it's your career.
Mm.
Like you can build model rockets and go to model rocket launching tournaments. I don't even know if they have those, but if they did,
they do.
Okay. They do. Okay. You could do that. You could launch rockets for a living. It's just don't count on prize money. Design rockets, market them, build a website, do a podcast, give lessons, teach classes. Put your name on the rockets, sell sponsorships to rockets that get on YouTube. I don't know. I mean, there's so many ways to make money in model rockets that don't involve prize money.
Mm. So how did you do it? Because I mean, where did you learn this skill? Because you're in your 20s. All right. You've been working a bit. You did a bit of college, but you know, understanding that there's more ways to make a living in this.
Well, so most of the ways that I monetize my sport, I came up with. I invented the model that all the players use today and for all these different ways, traveling around doing clinics and seminars and classes and merchandising, running events. I was the first person to do all those. It's you sit around and come up with ideas and then don't be afraid to try them.
Mm-hmm.
I came up with ideas that sounded good and then actually did them. Like the biggest gap that people have, the biggest barrier is there's this gap between I have a great idea and then actually doing the idea. And I don't understand why that's a gap. To me, that's a natural progression. Good idea is followed by do that idea. If it's a bad idea, you don't do it. But I've never had a good idea that I didn't do, because why would you not do a good idea? So I just did them. And then some of them succeeded. Some of them failed. I had some amazing ideas that made a lot of money. I had ideas that flopped where I lost money. It didn't matter. What mattered was that I tried the ideas that I thought would work, and some did.
Do you want to give us some ideas? What worked? What didn't work?
Sure. So I came up with the idea of traveling around the country teaching disc golf.
Right.
And then when I said, I'm going to teach disc golf, I said, what I'm going to do is I'm going to go to all the local clubs, because there's clubs all over the country, and I'm going to stand up and give a throwing clinic on how to play. Because there's a lot of amateurs there, not a lot of professionals. There was no YouTube videos, no tutorials. At the time, there was not even a book on how to play. So the actual technique of how to play was pretty much non-existent. It was everybody figuring out on their own. So I came up with the idea of going from town to town, because I was successful. I was winning tournaments, setting world records. I'm going to town and teach how to disc golf. But what I did was I didn't charge for the classes. I taught the classes for free, and that brought people out, lots of people out, because it's free. But then I ran an event where I gave away prizes. Well, prizes cost me less than the retail value of what I gave out, and people bought stuff.
Mm.
So I created the content that put eyes on what I was doing. And then once you're there, I got stuff for sale.
Which is interesting because what you did in the physical world is how the internet kind of works. And how Instagram kind of works and those sort of places. You're doing exactly the same thing.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that's really been my model. When I got out of disc golf, I did all, not all, but it was all online businesses. But the most common model was build and give away free content that put eyes on you. That could be entertaining. It could be educational. It could be informational. It could be useful. It doesn't matter what it is. If you're doing something that puts eyes on you, a percentage of those people that once you have their attention, when you recommend that they buy something, will buy that. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately what it comes down to is if I can get people to spend money somewhere where a profit is to be had, I'm entitled part of that profit if I'm the one that sent them there. Mm-hmm. And that's really what it comes down to. That's what all sports endorsements are. That's what all television advertising is. You know, if you attach my name to a product and you sell $10,000 worth of that product and make $5,000 profit, I'll lend you my name for $2,500. Mm-hmm. And that's where I'm being paid. I'm being paid for moving the meter at companies. Even if that company is your own company and you're the one doing the merchandising, you're sending people to move the meter at your company.
Yes.
But that's, you know, just so the overlying formula is not like, I we're not doing anything new on the internet. I mean, really, it's
no, of course not. But there are no, there's nothing new, is there? Really? It's always just a repeat of something else. Right. You know, it's like, and then, you know, the famous marketing systems—they're all a copy of something else. You know, like some of the some of the first book clubs and those sort of things. That process has been copied time and time and time again in different clubs. Now you can join whiskey clubs, and now you can have all sorts of clubs where you get regular amounts of wine, whiskey, or what have you.
If it's not broke, don't fix it.
No,
right?
Indeed. So, what was the journey for you in terms of this? Because you went on the road for a bit, and then you traveled around. I mean, I guess the US, a lot of golf courses to play.
Yeah.
Did you get bored of this, or was this, what did you do?
No, I didn't get bored. I played tournaments. At the time, there wasn't enough tournaments to play year round. So I would, every winter, I would snowboard for 3 or 4 months and I would cross train and just relax and have fun. I mean, I picked up some odd jobs over the winter, but they were just supplemental income. I made my money during the summers, and then I never got bored. I like being on the road. Like, to me, I it feels like prison. Like that really nice house in the suburbs with the nice yard and the nice foyer and the nice, you know, the nice basement with the pool table and the ping pong and the swimming pool, that's prison to me. Like, it's a box. I'm not judging anybody. Everyone has different things they like. There's nothing wrong with that being your dream home. But for me, it's the opposite of what I like. I feel just enclosed and want to just go. So I would be just itching to get back out again. When my daughter was born, that became more important to me than my own needs, because that's what you do as a parent. So I stopped traveling because I wanted to raise her. And I wanted to be home and I wanted to be around. I shared custody with her mom. Her mom was amazing. Great, great co-parenting. But I stopped traveling. And then when my daughter went to college, I just spent a little bit of time in some relationships with a partner with a kid, maybe a year younger, that I'm just waiting one more year before. And then after a couple of years, I just took off. And now I'm out just on the road. Like, I will never have a home, ever. Like, this is what I like.
Well, yeah, it's a great life to be. I mean, it's a great life to be if you can. I don't know. How do you handle that? Not having a place to be or you call your own. I mean, it's like.
But I do have a place to be. Wherever place I am is my place to be.
Yeah.
I mean, I never don't have a home because I get a hotel every single night. Okay. I mean, I like to backcountry camp and backpack, but that's for fun. I don't do that for financial reasons. Yeah. That's my hobby. But I do have a home. I have dinner waiting for me every single night. All I got to do is sit down at a table and ask someone, and they'll bring it to me for a premium rate.
Yeah.
I always have a washer and dryer in the hotel I'm staying at. I always have a dentist. My teeth hurt. There's a dentist in every town. Nobody really thinks this, what I'm about to say, but I think people feel this is the case. They grow up in a small town, even though they know it's not true, they feel like the only dentist, the only church, the grocery store, the only gas, the only coffee shop where they know how to make their latte, the only fill in the blank is theirs. And it's like, no, all this stuff exists elsewhere. And I also don't like, I don't like repeating stuff.
That's the difference in you. Cause a lot of people like familiarity. There's that thing, that regularity, familiarity. You're someone that doesn't like it. You don't want familiarity.
Yeah. It's funny when you say this, cause the best example of this is chain restaurants. Like the reason people go to chain restaurants is because they can count on the food tasting the same every single time. I don't like chain restaurants because the food tastes the same every single time.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah.
Everywhere we go to we do local barbecue. And that's great. And by the way, not a chain. I want to go and see what some big fat redneck in a wife beater shirt. Like, I want to see what they think good barbecue sauce is. And it's amazing, even if it's not exactly the way I would have liked it, it's theirs. And I get to enjoy that. And then I don't have to eat it again. The joke my girlfriend and I make actually is, like, as soon as we can find the hotel without back to the hotel without GPS, that's when it's time to go. That's when we're way too familiar. You know, there's just so much of the world to see. Like, I'm going to die not having seen 99.9% of the world. Like, it's not like I'm going to see it all. If I could see it all, maybe I would, get a house someday. But like, there's always something new to see.
So what have been the challenges for you?
For what I'm doing?
Yeah, just life generally. I mean, Life, Passion, and Business is about the journey of life. That's what we're about here.
Yeah. So the biggest challenges are my biggest failings as an adult happened 2012, 2013. When I was home for about 13 years, and I, about 10 or 11 of those years, I was wildly successful on the internet. I made a ton of money with my online businesses, like stupid money. And I thought that I was bulletproof. I actually did the same mistake that I would counsel everyone in the world against, but I thought that I thought everything I touched on the internet turned to gold. What I didn't recognize was, I might be pretty good at this stuff, but so much of my success was timing. It was the right time to be in on the early days of the internet. And so it wasn't around 2013, making money online stopped being as easy as it was before 2013. And all of a sudden my businesses stopped doing well. And so I had one brief period in my life where I started losing money, foreclosures. This is when I had a house. I had a big old house full of worthless stuff, but I furnished every room full of stuff. But I failed in my business, and then with that failed marriage, failed business, and for a very brief period of my life I had problems with substance abuse. I came to this bizarre conclusion, and I don't know what I was thinking, but this really weird conclusion that the reason my businesses were failing was because I had to sleep for 6 or 7 hours a night. And that if I could only get rid of sleeping 2 out of every 3 nights, that would be an extra 30 hours a week I could work. I could save my businesses and save my marriage. Obviously.
That didn't work well by the sounds of that one.
I would argue that's never worked well for anybody in the history of amphetamine abuse.
No.
But at the time it would seem logical. But the thing about that was, all these altruistic motives, trying to save my family and my house and all that, those things quickly turn into, I'm just using drugs because I'm addicted to drugs. It had nothing to do with, honorable motives. It's at first it did, eventually not. And so that was the biggest failing in my life. It didn't last for long. That has not been an issue for the last 7 years. But that, that was probably the biggest pitfall in my life. And so life is back to where it was before. I just had to do things, make adjustments.
So you got back on the road and started playing again, right? So,
yeah, back on the being on the road is what helped me. Being around my peers and my Frisbee family. I still had a daughter to raise, so I went back and I got into software sales for like 3 years. It turns out that they'll pay you, you know, $100,000 or $200,000 if you're good at selling software. So it was, I was working for someone else, but it was a lot of fun. It was, you know, dopamine hits, you know, constantly because it's sales. So I enjoyed it, but only as a means to an end. It was always just a placeholder till I could get back on the road.
Mm-hmm. So you got back into the circuit playing Frisbee again and playing golf again. I mean, what makes a good player? Cause you said you did very well early in the early days. Is it something that do you age on this? Cause I would have thought it's not that about physique, this thing. It's about precision, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because you certainly age. Sports that are high strength and high aerobic sports. I mean, if you're a lightweight mixed martial arts fighter, your career is peaking and coming to its twilight by like 33 years old. You know, there's certain sports where you peak. If you play baseball, you can probably play into your late 30s, right? And if you play ball golf, you could probably play to like your mid 40s. And that's we're kind of along that line. Father Time has never lost a competitive sporting event ever, right? Like, yes, I am not anywhere near as competitive as I was as I'm older, but that's not the important part. I make money through so many other ways in the sport that I'm extremely comfortable and getting more comfortable by the day.
Are you considered someone like are you one of the elites of this sport? Are you considered highly in the sport? Do they recognize you in the sport?
So yes and no. I am probably, at least in my opinion, considered the best teacher in the sport. I wrote the first book on disc golf throwing technique. I've done more than 500 seminars around the country, 500 clinics. I charge the most money, if that's any metric on teaching. I do full day seminars for groups of 7 people, where each person pays a premium times 7. So by that metric, I'm the best teacher, and I'm very much respected in that area. I'm respected as a player for what I accomplished, but the level of play that I play to now, I'm respected for my age. So for a 51-year-old man, I'm shooting really, really well, just about at the top of my age division. But compared to the 25-year-olds who are out on tour, there's a gap.
Mm. Yeah, as you say, you don't have the strength anymore, probably.
Yeah, you lose something. I'm older. No big deal.
Yeah, part of the journey.
Yeah.
So how do you define success for yourself these days?
How do I define success? By not going back into a cubicle and not having an apartment or a house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as long as I am free and I'm doing exactly what I want to do with my life every single day, that's successful to me. This winter, we are going to take 4 months off for the winter. We're going to go south of the equator, Patagonia, New Zealand, and Tasmania for 4 months. As long as I can decide to do that and then go do that for 4 months and not work, that's successful because I'm doing exactly what I want to do. If I had 10 times as much money, that does not alter what I do. So I have no financial barrier to what I choose to do. As long as I'm able to do that, then that's successful because anything more than that, I don't need. So being able to take 4 months off and just travel around the world and not have to worry about money is successful to me.
Sounds like you've found a winning formula by the sounds of it.
Yeah, it is. You know, I'm happy. Ultimately, yeah. I'm living my life exactly as I want to. And I don't think most people are not that they're not able to, but they don't do that. They fit into a box that other put them in or that they put themselves in. And I think if you're in the box, that's not your box that you're supposed to be in, you're going to be unhappy.
Well, the difference is a lot of the people that have that box, they have the success metric that was given to them by someone else. They haven't defined what success is for themselves.
Yeah,
and they're trying to fit someone else's model.
Yeah, I mean, my ex-wife is a perfect example. She's the exact opposite of me. For her, successful is the home, the security, the beautiful home, the stable family, you know. And then she has achieved everything she has wanted to in the world, and she is as successful as I am, and we have wildly different lives. But I would be miserable living her life. She would be miserable living my life. So it's success isn't defined by what I think is or my metric. It's defined by what every individual feels is their metric. For some people, success is, it's just getting, they have four kids and getting all four of their kids and turning them into successful, independent, self-supporting adults who are happy. And you know, I could say, wow, living vicariously through your children, that's not what I would like. Well, that's not how I would want to live. But to them, that is their measure of success. So that is what they should be doing.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I'm about here. That's what this is about. It's why I asked the question. Part of my framework that I promote for everybody to use is know this stuff for yourself. Know what you're passionate about. You know what success means to you. And have these answers for yourself, not on someone else's. Because when you have them for yourself, you're living your good life, and that's what's really is about, isn't it? Living that good life. I think what is very clear to me is that it's because you don't need security. That's where it all works for you, because you are so happy just to be free and have the confidence to know that you can sort anything out.
Yeah, I do need security. I have more security than anybody I know, because I can't fail anywhere I go.
Well, yeah, okay, yeah.
But if your security is your home or your retirement, and then if you are in a situation where you're vulnerable to losing that, then you're vulnerable. I mean, you're probably around my age. Like, you've known how many people in your life that thought they had security when they were 40 years old and realized at 45 they didn't? Happens all the time. They, you know, all it takes is one illness or one.
Well, absolutely. Thing. Yeah. Often security gets taken away for you by things that are out of your control.
Yeah. And but I can't have security taken away from me, because my ability to function. I mean, I suppose catastrophic medical illness will take that away, but that's going to ruin anybody's life, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, but realistic life problems. But when COVID hit, we went out to the desert. We spent the summer in the desert while we watched the news to see what was going to happen and see. Just, we watched it play out, but we didn't have to go to a job where we were putting ourselves at risk. We were able to just, all right, let's not work for the next few months. Let's just go. Let's go camping. Let's go have fun out, you know, out in the mountains and desert and wait. But the security is that I could just do that.
Yeah. You had the choice. Yeah.
And that is worth everything to me. Mm. You know, one of the funny things that people ask too, which is like, what motivates me? Ironically, it is fear to some extent.
I would never have guessed that.
Well, because a lot of it is fear and anxiety over not living the way I live. I need to be successful financially, because I don't want to have to do those things that I would need for security. The security is knowing that I can always do them. If I had to, I could go take a job, get an apartment for 4 or 5 months, start up a new business and do it. I mean, I could do that, but that's the security, is the knowledge that I have that option. But the fear is I don't want to have to do that.
Mm.
I worked really hard to put myself in a position, you know, like right now we make more money than we spent. It's coming faster than we spend. And that is a position that everyone should be in. That paycheck to paycheck model of life is never devoid of anxiety. There's always anxiety when you are this close to not failure, but to trouble.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And the majority of people live like that.
It is. And so I work very hard to not be in that position, but I have the security knowing that if that does happen, I'll still be fine.
Mm.
It's just not my first choice.
So what do you see as your contribution to the world?
Well, I've run 281. I just ran my 281st event for kids and adults with special needs.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. All of those events are free for the kids and their families. I give them discs. I give them shirts. I fund it all myself. When I compete in tournaments now, this is one of the things I'm lucky enough to do. I don't make a lot of money playing tournaments, but it's, you know, $300 to $1,000 a weekend that's kind of in the ballpark of what I get paid every weekend in prize money. Every single tournament, I ask the tournament director to donate my prize money to a local autism organization.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're asking about prize money, I actually don't even play for prize money. The more I win, the more they just give away.
Wow.
So I'm able to do this because I make money other ways. So I don't need the prize money. And you know, $500 to $1,000 a week isn't a lot of money, but it's a ton of money to these small organizations where $500, they can buy something that they needed that they wouldn't have been able to buy. I only work with small organizations because I have a hard time seeing, like, $500 to $1,000 doesn't mean anything to major organizations.
No.
But to a local house that does assisted living for 6 clients, $500 is like groceries, right? So that's probably the biggest like charity type contribution I make. I don't play for prize money. All of my lessons, all my teaching clinics are free for anybody that works in the special needs community, as well as anybody with family in the special needs community. So I take that financial barrier to getting my teaching, I take that off the table for people that have more important things to spend money on than disc golf lessons.
What made you choose that community?
So this is an interesting story, and I love sharing this. I started becoming involved in that community because I was trying to impress a girl.
Okay.
And I love sharing the story because I think people can take this high and mighty altruistic like stance about why they do these noble things in the world. And I have a problem with that. It usually comes across smarmy and arrogant. My reasons were I was trying to impress a girl. I didn't have any other reason. However, our relationship didn't work out, but once I became actively involved in the community, I fell in love with it. And then I just wanted to help the people in the community. But that's not where it started. I've made entire videos about this topic because I don't give a shit why people do good things. I don't think it matters what your motive is for doing good things. If you're doing good things, that's all that matters.
Yeah.
So I have a pet peeve, like, okay, I'm not religious, but when they're passing on the dish at church and somebody has a house fire, they're trying to raise money for it. So they pass around the coffers to raise money. And let's suppose somebody puts $200 in the thing. And the only reason they're doing it is so all the people around them can see that they donated $200, right? These people get knocked for it. Oh, they're just looking for attention or a pat on the back. In my opinion, who gives a shit? What matters is the family that needed it got $200, not 20 from them. So if the reason for doing good things is ego, if it's because you enjoy praise, if it's because it's for a tax write-off, if it's because it's a good promotion for your business that you're going to profit from, I don't care the reason. What matters is you're doing good things, whatever that motives are. And when you're critical of people for their motives for doing good things, they do less good things. So that's why I like to share. My motives for the autism community didn't start off as doing good things. It started off about a girl. But that's okay. It ended with me doing good things for...
And maybe the universe put that girl in your way so that you would end up doing good things for some people.
It's possible.
It's possible. It's possible, isn't it?
Yeah.
So how do you contribute to yourself?
Because I do everything I want to do that makes me happy.
Oh, well, yeah, you do, don't you? Yeah, it's easy, really.
I deny myself anything. I have everything I want in the world. There's nothing, if I want something, I'll just get it.
Yeah.
I don't mean financially. I mean, I decided 4 months ago that I wanted to go ride horses in Patagonia this winter.
Yeah.
So, just, we're going.
Yeah.
That's not a really, I mean, it's not cheap, but that's not the most expensive vacation out there. There's a lot higher end vacations.
I'm sure there are.
But I want to ride horses, so I ride horses.
Yeah.
By the way, I don't really know how to ride a horse. I just decided that's what I wanted to do.
Well, you're going to learn pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to learn quickly. You know, so I applied the same logic to the relationship that I'm in, where I stopped trying to look for things that I thought were what was important in a relationship and went after who I wanted to be with. And to have a relationship that doesn't match a traditional relationship. I reinvented that model the same way I invented my career, which was, why does a relationship have to look a certain way? As if everybody on planet Earth should have the same type of relationship? That doesn't make any sense. Although when you're 20 years old, that's what you think it's supposed to be. Like, oh, of course you date, you get intimate, you move in together, you get engaged, you get married. You have kids. It's this relationship escalator. That's, you're monogamous.
Well, that's biology. That's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? And you know, that's what we're supposed to do in early relationships because it's what it does. When you have relationships later life, you've got all that baggage and you know the difference. And the relationships are a different thing when you get older.
Yeah, I mean, biologically, I mean, we're, you know, to make baby, you don't need a relationship to make a baby, though, right?
No, I know you don't, but society pushes you to have a relationship for it, and your biology is pushing you to go for that direction, isn't it? That's what's happening.
Yeah, but the idea, but even that relationship doesn't have to look the same as every, and there seems to be this cookie cutter model, just like with career, relationship, education. You know,
it's changing a lot now, isn't it? It's totally changing now, isn't it?
It definitely is changing for sure. There's a generational gap. My girlfriend's mom, every time we talk on the phone, she asks me when I'm going to marry her daughter. And my answer is I'm not. like, you know, but my daughter doesn't ask me when I'm going to marry my girlfriend. So you're right. It is. I think it is changing.
You know, I mean, my cousin and her partner in a gay relationship, they decided to have a child. And I had to explain it. And I thought, well, my father's going, well, how did that happen? And I had to explain it to my dad how it would happen. He goes, I don't get that. He goes, but why? You know, and this is years ago now. But, you know, life has changed. It's different.
Yeah, it is. It is more accepting. It's definitely going the right direction. But that's the key to happiness, is to reinvent your own model. What's important to me? I wrote every single thing down. I mean, that my career, my relationships, everything. Like I put it all in writing. You know, you separate your needs from your wants. Like this, what do I need in life and what do I want in life? The needs are the non-negotiables. Like there's no wrong answers there. If someone says, I need to make $300,000 a year to be happy, I can't tell that person they're wrong. I can't tell them that they're shallow, they're superficial. If that person needs that much money to be happy, that's their number, then that's what they need.
The chances are, though, when they get there, they won't be happy.
No, they may turn out to be wrong, but they may also not be happy until they get there if they think they need it.
Yeah.
You know, so figure out what you need, and then you figure out the wants, but the wants have to all be negotiable.
Yeah.
So the needs are non-negotiable. I don't mean food, sex, and shelter. I mean the needs being whatever those needs are. And then after that, it's the wants. You get some of the wants, but you have to compromise on wants. You're never going to get all your wants, but you need to get all your needs. If it's a need, that has to be non-negotiable in your life.
Mm-hmm. I think you're probably right.
Yeah.
So Scott, what's the one question you like people to ask you?
One question I'd like them to ask me. Well, if they wanted me to be on a soapbox, I love people asking me about their careers, about, you know, especially if they're younger, about how to go after the things that they want in life, because mm-hmm. the gap between the amount of people that have good ideas and the amount of people that do those ideas, they're like most people don't do, they talk. And I like to explore why, because most often there's no good reason for not doing things. Sometimes there is. you want to travel around the country and be, you know, tour with the band, but you have two kids at home, that's a good reason to not go tour with the band. It just is. At least I think it is. But those reasons are rare. Most of the time, the reasons for not doing something are bullshit. Their fear, their anxiety, their ignorance. There's, you know, I like to explore those things. Like just asking somebody. By the way, I get these questions all the time because of how I live my life. People ask me all the time, and like if they're afraid of something not working out. And okay, that's not unreasonable. You're afraid of failing and something not unreasonable. But as soon as you ask the person, what does failure look like? Like if that doesn't work out, like someone wants to go on tour and compete, but they don't know if they're good enough. So they're afraid they're going to go out and not do good enough. And it's like, okay, well, they're 22 years old. Well, okay, well, what does that look like? You go out on tour, turns out you're not good enough yet. That's what you're afraid of. Well, what's it going to look like? Well, I'm going to run out of money. Well, then what are you going to do? Well, then I'm going to have to go home. And then what? I probably have to live with my parents for a month while I look for a job. And then what? Well, then I'm going to get a job and get an apartment. Oh, you mean exactly the way you were before you left to go on tour? And they go, oh, yeah, you're right. Failing out on the road, worst case scenario, you're right back where you started. You haven't lost a thing. You actually have gained experience and knowledge, but that's hard to quantify and reassure people with. But when they realize, you're right, failing doesn't mean anything. I go back, sleep in my parents' basement for a month and then get a job. All of a sudden it's like, well, that's nothing to be afraid of. Failure doesn't mean you're being fed to the lions, you know, or but once you actually analyze what failure looks like, it's usually not that scary. One more example of that. I want to ask that woman out on a date, but I'm afraid. Okay, that's not unreal. Like, that's normal. Like, people get anxiety over talking. Guys get anxiety over talking to a pretty girl. Not uncommon. So they're afraid, so they don't do it. But then you ask them, well, what is it going to look like if you ask her? Well, she might say no. Well, how's that going to feel if she says no? Well, I'm not going to like it. Well, how long will you not like it? About 4 minutes. All right. And then what are you going to do after that? I don't know. Probably go play pinball at the arcade. It's like, oh, shit. Turns out that rejection wasn't that big of a deal once you actually analyze what it looked like. It was only the unknown that makes you afraid to do it, because rejection is such a big, horrible thing, right?
I wonder where all this comes from, though. Where all this fear of rejection and failure comes from? Where was it put into people? Because it seems such a limiting thing. And you don't have it. Was it? I mean, did you not have it as a child? I mean, where did it go for you? Because you don't sound like you're afraid of anything.
No, I'm not afraid of failing. That's for sure. I'm afraid of lots.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, I know you're afraid of not getting what you want, but I mean, or getting your needs met, should I say? But I mean, where did this no fear of failure come from? Because it's very rare to have this.
So probably because I overthink everything. But I analyze everything. I analyze what failure looks like.
I know you know now, but where did it come from in the beginning? Where was the first experience of this when you kind of learned this technique?
I'm not sure. I guess I don't ever remember being afraid to try things.
Right. You're obviously born with it.
Well, so a lot of it, you know, like, when I took off to go travel to play disc golf full time, I had the level of anxiety I felt over not doing that and then winding up working for this Yahoo that wouldn't give me a vacation day off for the life. That fear was so great, I would do anything to not have that happen to me.
Yeah.
So maybe some of it is just choosing the lesser of two evils. Like it might sting for a second to be rejected by the pretty girl, but it'll sting for 5 minutes or for 2 days if I don't go ask her.
Well, there's always the exact, yeah, absolutely. The anxiety of like not actually taking the thing, there is, you know, that is awful. That I didn't do it, yes.
Yeah, but really it's just like, what does it matter? Like, what does failure matter? Like you failed, why is that a bad thing?
Yeah, you
flip a coin 100 times. If you call tails a failure 50 times, you're going to fail. So what? Like, what does failure look like? if it's harming somebody, I mean, when I failed in my business, that was a failure. That was a legit failure because I had a partner that I felt responsible for. I lost our home. It doesn't matter that she's an adult who could work also. I felt responsible for her. And so that failure affected others. So that was something that was a legitimate failure that I believe I was right to be afraid of happening.
Yeah. When, as you say, when you do something, you fail or have an accident or do something and someone gets physically hurt or hurt in some way, that is not so nice.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not taking any of that lightly, but those are also, that's not what fear of failure is. In fact, most people don't consider that a fear of failure. That's a legitimate fear. It's like, it's like a fear of crocodiles if you're in the Everglades. It's not an unreasonable fear. Like, no one thinks that's stupid, right? Mm-hmm. But being afraid of crocodiles in Montana doesn't make sense. So
I take it as someone living in Scotland, I wouldn't know, but I guess there are no crocodiles in Montana.
It's like being afraid of...
Yeah, I know. It's fine. Right. It's fine. I get the gist. Oh dear. It's funny. I was talking to someone this morning about running and about going out endurance running. And he's in Australia. And, you know, my problem about running is getting out in there. And his problem about running is avoiding snakes and leeches.
Yeah.
And okay. That's pretty nasty.
Yeah, so here you go. If you're afraid of snakes in Australia, that's reasonable. If you're afraid of snakes in New Zealand, right? I want to go to Australia. We're planning to go to New Zealand and Tasmania, but I'm sure we'll stop in Australia for a few days or a week. There are so many things in Australia that can kill you. Am I afraid of nothing? Absolutely not. I'm terrified of everything in Australia.
Well, watch out for the dunny spider. Apparently, it's pretty lethal.
Box jellyfish, like every out there, like I don't care what the statistics say. Like everything in Australia can kill you.
Oh well, fair enough. So, hopefully not Australians. But there we go.
I have a funny story for you. So there, I saw a sign. This is like how. I mean, Australians might be the most badass people on earth. They're the toughest people on earth, maybe, at least according to what I saw. So there was a sign on a beach in Australia that there was a photograph of that said, no swimming at this beach because of saltwater crocodiles, right? So there's saltwater crocodiles at this beach. So they recommend you go to a beach on the sign 100 meters away. Tell me that's not those aren't the craziest people on earth.
Yes, I would have thought a saltwater crocodile can make 100 meters pretty easily, but there we go, maybe they can't. I don't know, maybe we don't know something there.
I don't know, I just think they're crazy. So anyways, yes. Australians are
anyway, well, you'll find out. So look, how do people get in touch with you if they need to? What are you looking for? Are you looking for people to contact you? Are you looking to teach people stuff? What would you like the outcome of this podcast to be for you?
So right now, I mean, I'm trying to gain more mainstream exposure towards just my brand. I'm one of the first players out, like, to take things in disc golf and take them outside of disc golf. I don't know where that's going to lead. I have my autobiographies out, for example. It's got 5 stars on Amazon. It's doing really well. The audio version of my autobiography, Scott Stokely, Growing Up Disc Golf, is out. I want to turn that into a movie. I'm looking for contacts to do that. I'm absolutely open to public speaking or following any path that comes in front of me. One of the things about being an entrepreneur is that you can intentionally go after certain things, but a lot of things also happen when you put yourself out there and put yourself in certain environments. So for me, the more exposure I get, the more opportunities will come my way. So if 1,000 people listen to this podcast, I don't know the numbers, but probably 300 of them think I'm arrogant and would never want to like talk to me. And probably another 200 think I'm crazy and 430 think I'm full of shit. But maybe 70 people go, that's really good stuff there. And if one of those 70 people manages public speakers, well, then reach out to me and let's talk about it. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's exposure.
Yeah, you are but open to the opportunity that this may bring you.
Yeah, but as far as what I'm looking for specifically, I don't have an agenda. I mean, right now I'm getting my movie made and some merchandising things. I mean, I have different business ventures that I'm doing. I mean, I'm the hardest working person in disc golf, but I just finished writing another book. The first draft is done. So I keep plenty busy, but that doesn't mean that I'm not open to opportunities. Also, by the way, mainstream sponsorships. That's the other thing I guess I would be seeking. Right now, I will, like next year on YouTube, it's hard to predict exactly, but I'll get somewhere between 10 and 25 million views on my YouTube channel.
Yeah.
There are certainly YouTubers that get far more than that, but 10 to 25 million isn't nothing. And I am seeking some mainstream sponsorship for that. I can move the meter on companies. I have enough audience where when I tell people to go shop here or to buy product there, people will. So anyone that's looking to endorse or do any type of promotion, I have reach. Right. That's probably it.
So how would people get in touch with you?
Sure. ScottStokely.net. Mm-hmm. And it's Scott, STOKELY, not LEY, STOKELY. Although if you just search for Scott Stokely, I'll come up at the top. Cause like once you get like a wiki page and stuff, Google tends to like think you're important or something. I don't know. But so if you search, you'll find me, but go to my website, contact me.
Are you on social media at all?
Oh yeah, of course. I'm all over Facebook and Instagram and YouTube are the big ones. I keep active elsewhere, but those are the ones where I do all my promotion.
Fair enough. Well, all those links will be available at the podcast Life, yeah. Passion and Business, including the links to the book. And yeah. Let's hope someone interesting connects with you.
I love it, man. I really enjoyed the conversation. I do a lot of these from the car, and I don't know how else not to do that. Like, we're on our way from Minneapolis to Fargo, which is about a 2.5-hour drive across the northern tip of the country.
Wasn't there a film called Fargo?
Yes, there was. Oh, you betcha.
Yeah, there was, wasn't there? It was quite a violent one, I seem to remember. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's actually a brilliant, brilliant movie. But
it is a good movie. It is a good movie. I just remembered it because you remember that. I recognize that name from somewhere. Well, there we go.
Yeah.
So I come to my last question, which is the question I ask everyone, and I'm intrigued how you're going to answer this.
Okay.
So, Scott, what's the meaning of life for you?
To be happy. It's the meaning of life is to do what brings you joy, because you have a finite number of hours on this planet. And every hour you're not doing something that brings you joy, you're wasting those hours. Now, not
29,500 hours you get in an average life.
Yeah. And by the way, it doesn't mean every hour has to be joyful, but those hours that aren't joyful should be being used towards creating joy during the other hours.
Mm.
Whatever that joy is. But I can't answer for anybody else what that looks like. Yeah, the meaning of life is to figure out what drives you, what makes you happy, what gives you satisfaction, makes you fulfilled, makes you secure. You know, I mean, love. I mean, I can say that love is the most important thing in the world, but it doesn't mean that's the most important thing to the next person. And they're not wrong. If they're the next person, it can be all about materialistic things and having the biggest boat in their driveway. They're not wrong for that. I'm wrong if I do it. They're not. So
absolutely. There's no argument to there. Absolutely no arguments at this point. You, it is up to each of us to find our own. And I'm very pleased you have an answer.
Yeah, I do. I do have an answer. I got one shot at life. I'm more than halfway done with my life. Like I'm going to live every minute of the rest of my life like it's my last.
Wow. Scott Stokely, thank you so much for taking the time to be with me and chat with me in your car or van.
I know.
It's been great to have this conversation, and I'll let you get back on your journey.
Yeah, by the way, not just the car, it's a Jeep. It's a 2005 Jeep Wrangler. It is the worst travel vehicle ever made, but our Jeep has its own blog. It's called Adventure Travels with Luna. Luna's the name of the Jeep. This is our kid. So we will never give up we're just going to keep pumping money into our Jeep, our old Jeep.
I will put that link on the podcast as well, because I think it's going to be fun.
There's nothing exciting there. It's just pictures of all of our adventures, but there's a lot of them.
Oh, that's nice to know. Thanks so much, Scott. All the best.
Yeah, man, I appreciate it. Thank you so much. Loved it. Bye.
And that was Life, Passion and Business with Paul Harvey and my guest, Scott Stokely, the professional Frisbee player. If you want to discover more about Scott or the game of disc golf, check out Scott's links. That is scottstokely.net. You can also find him on Facebook, on Instagram, YouTube and LinkedIn. Now, following my conversation with Scott, I found out there was a course near me, and so my son and I had to give it a go and play. And I have to say, my years of beach frisbee certainly paid off. It was great fun and well worth a try. So all of the links for Scott will be available at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com. And if I can find that photograph of my son and I playing disc golf, I will post that there as well. My apologies if the edits are a bit choppy today. This is a very old podcast and I didn't have the original file, so I had to improvise a bit taking the recording from Podbean, which meant it was a bit merged. Some of the sound transitions were a bit lumpy, so apologies. Anyway, as I said at the beginning, we're going to talk about focus coaching. Okay, so we're all looking to move forward. We all want to find some measure of success in the world. And if you've heard the podcast, you know I have a view of success, but that's another conversation. But the point is, however you look at this, we want to get things done. You might want to get a project over the line. You might have a really big goal that you're looking to move forward on. And the problem is, whenever we start these projects, whenever we do anything like this, there's always some resistance. There's always something that gets in the way. And that can be a multitude of things. But the key to this is, how do we retain focus and stay with the project and push it over the line? And that's where focus coaching can help. Now, it's a process that I discovered some 15 years ago during my coach training. And it's something sometimes called focus coaching, turbo coaching, speed coaching. And it's a really simple process where we define what it is you're trying to achieve. And we look at the resistance that you're experiencing in that achievement. Come up with some strategies to solve that resistance. Commit to setting a date, and I hold your feet to the fire to make sure that you do that. So there's a commitment, there's an accountability process. And that's it. That's basically how it works. You get it done. And I can tell you, it is so powerful when you start working in this way, particularly when you work with someone who supports you in the process of doing it. And one thing to remember, you know, success is never guaranteed, but the struggle always is. And that's what this coaching is designed to do. It's designed to get you through the struggle towards the success you're looking for. So do check out the link on this podcast or at the website lifepassionandbusiness.com. You will find a video of me again explaining this process. But if you go below the video, there's a booking link where we'll have a discussion about your project and how we could get you sorted. As always, if you have enjoyed this podcast, if you found anything here of any use, please share it with a friend, because that's how people like yourself find good podcasts. If you can, give us a review. Give us a 5-star review. I have lots of 5 stars. Why not? I think I'm worth it. When you support a podcast in that way, you have no idea how effective it is, both in terms of supporting us on the platform, but it also makes us feel good. Yes, it makes me feel good, and I like to feel good. As always, thank you for your time and attention. I will catch you next time.